you get asked questions about your career, and then you recite your resume, and it sounds like this straight line from college to the director's office. And, you know, I think when I talk honestly with my peers, it's anything but. I think the most important thing to say is, in some ways, you sort of, I failed my way to the top.
I wish I could fail like this.
That's right. Well, trust me, you can.
This is pdxpodcast.com. Thanks for tuning in. That was Andrew Proctor. He's the Executive Director of Literary Arts. And he's had a very interesting career path. At one point, he was a professional house sitter. I don't know how that's even a job, but yes, he did that. Since joining Literary Arts in 2009, he's helped more than double their operating budget. You know, when I was told I was going to speak to the executive director of a literary nonprofit, I expected a guy in a tweed blazer with a bow tie who was about 1 million years old and used words like proliferation and who would talk down to me for 40 minutes. That's not what happened. My name is Gregory Day. You're listening to pdxpodcast.com, also pdxpod.com. Also, covering Seattle at northwestpodcast.com. And my first question was about that explosive growth of the nonprofit and his role in that.
So we went from an operating budget of $900,000 in 2009, to an operating budget of this year, $2.45 million. So that's a lot of growth. Here's what I would say. I think that the organization in 2008 and 2009 had plateaued a little bit for a few years, and was a little bit of a lull, and was a little bit unsure what was next. Right? Not totally unsure, but just a little like unsure. But it had a tremendous potential, right? And I didn't know that necessarily.
You saw the potential.
I think I was sort of awoken to it when I first got here and began to sort of really look at it carefully. So it was an organization in good financial shape. It had a great reputation in town. Yeah. It had access to really talented people. Yeah. And hadn't maybe fully realized that potential yet. And so the process was really organic. I will say that. I think there's two things going on. I think we got a group of people together on the board, on the staff, who were really dynamic individuals, who really believed in the mission and knew how to communicate that mission and knew how to bring resources to that mission. That's a group effort. And then I think the second thing is we find ourselves in 2009 at the bottom of a crash.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it was harrowing. We all, you know,
yeah, it really was.
Investment income was, there was no income at all. But oh my God, the balance sheets were, like, frightening. But there's a massive ecosystem change happening within literature that is national, international. And that has to do, someone once told me there were, in the 1990s, there were 9 bookstores downtown Portland, and there's 1 now, basically. Mm. And Powell's is amazing. I like that. You couldn't find a place I love more in a bookstore. However, one bookstore is not an ecosystem. And so the idea that we were losing independent bookstores, that the city, as it recovered in the economy, became a more expensive place for artists to be, a real need in the ecosystem became, well, who's gonna create a place and a space and some resources so that we can have this for the city? And people really wanted it. And you know, a really recent example of that was we added a new program to the organization, which was the book festival called Wordstock, which was previously an independent organization. And the question before us and the board was, why is this not working, this festival? So a lot of smart people tried to make the festival work in its last couple of years and were unable to. Is it because the city doesn't want this? Is this not desirable? Is this not what we need right now? Or is there something else that we can do to reinvigorate it? And what we found was people really want, people came out in the many, many thousands to the book festival we put it on. And that is because we touched a nerve. And that nerve has to do with the ecosystem beyond our control, right? That I find in my work, and what I find invigorating and inspiring and exciting, is that people want to be together. They, when you put something smart on that's relevant, they will show up and be together in it, and will dwell in it, and will pay for it, and will help, and will pay for it enough that they want other people to have it so that they can go for free. So that we have donors now who, you know, we provide thousands of seats every year in the concert hall to those who cannot afford it, whether they're students or otherwise. And my patrons are happy to pay for them. And they're really excited to have those kids in the venue or those other groups in the venue. So, yeah. So I think that at its root. And so we just began to talk about the mission and to fundraise and to focus ourselves and to say that, you know what, in some ways growth does matter. Growth is about reaching more people and having more impact. And so to
your mission statement is very inspiring. I'm going to read it here. Our mission is to engage readers, support writers, and inspire the next generation with great literature.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an inspiring statement, and it's on the front page of your Facebook page, it's on the front page of your website.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you like it. That mission, the crafting that mission statement, which replaced a previous one about 5 years ago, was a painful process and hard to produce. You know, I have a lot of people among us who love words, and so they have a lot of opinions about that. But it is, again, even that mission statement is not a product of somebody sitting at a desk by themselves. It was a process of months and months and months of us imagining who we want to be, who we want to serve, and how we want to do it. The board and the staff are incredible people who have dedicated themselves to something that I think is really important, and I think they think it's really important.
So you attribute a lot of the growth to them also.
I mean, yeah, like I said, this is just a massive...
The growth is incredible. Yeah. It really is. The numbers are incredible.
The numbers are great, and that is a massive collaborative effort. You know, this work is not possible by a single director. Yes, I am the spokesperson for the organization. I'm the face of it in many places. I do the introductions. I talk on the radio show. You do need to focus people's energy a little bit on an individual. But, you know, we hired for the festival, you know, Amanda Bullock came from New York City from Housing Works and put on an incredible festival. My education director, you know, coordinates an effort that reaches 4,000 high school students every single year in almost every single high school in the city. Or, you know, the person who runs our programs for writers, you know, runs the Oregon Book Awards, but also runs classes and workshops and all that stuff year round. I mean, I'm not doing that.
No.
You know, I mean,
a lot of different branches.
There's a lot of different branches and people who are bringing incredible expertise. And on the board side, you have, you know, lawyers who do the legal work and make significant contributions and lean on their corporate clients to make contributions. And you have winemakers who also do work on make sure that our finances are in good order. I mean, we are rich in friends, and that means you can do a lot. We've been bringing the Moth here now for almost 7 years.
Yeah.
And we present them in the large, that's our largest venue in the country, the Schnitzer. But there, you know, the local town thing, I think it's an important.
It was sold out.
Sold out, yeah. I mean, the Moth's so fantastic. I mean, yeah. You know, and we love working with them. I mean, I worked with the Moth ladies when I was in New York, and it was fun to bring them here.
Started out small.
Right? Moth was very small, 97, and was when they were founded. And we brought the main stage, we helped launch the slams here that are once a month, story slams.
That's right.
Yeah, and those are great because anybody can go to those. You put your name in a hat. You know, you might get a chance to tell a story. The crowd votes.
Yeah.
It borrows heavily from slam and performance poetry in that sense.
Now, in addition to his work at Literary Arts, Andrew is also the host of the Archive Project on OPB.
The content of the show is primarily, you know, these amazing writers from throughout our history who are giving these incredible hour-long talks. And, you know, whether it's Wallace Stegner in the 80s or Doris Lessing in the 90s or Ondaatje at the peak of, you know, The English Patient or whatever, and they reflect on writing, on their lives, and often on what's going on around the world. And so it really helps us
get perspective on those times. I think they could be very useful. And some of the talks are really writerly, and some of those talks are broader than that, you know, and it just depends on the writer and the time and place when it happened. And then, you know, the show also now, we run a big book festival in the fall, so we record a lot of events.
You're not kidding, you run a big book festival in the fall.
Yeah, so we record all those events, and OPB hosts many of those events, so those become part of the archive project too. And then lately we've been experimenting, the show's sort of evolving, right, and so we've been experimenting with, like we did the, we host the All City High School Poetry Slam Championships every spring. So
yeah,
we did
Verslandia.
This Verslandia, and so we did a show where we took the best of those poems that were the performances, and then Anis Majgani, who's the international 2-time slam champion, you know, for adults, lives here in Portland. People, I think, feel like should know this more. He's an incredible person and an incredible artist. And so we got a chance. I got a chance to sit down with him and just talk about race and poetry. Yeah. Because, you know, Verslandia, you know, holds a diversity of kids that is uncommon.
It's a great show.
Yeah.
It is a great, great show.
And it's uncommon in the Northwest to see that diversity and range of kids up there together.
Yes.
And so what's exciting about that, because I'm a huge book nerd and a huge believer in the power of the word, is that they're all, the thing that binds those disparate population together is this love of poetry. And so, you know, when people tell me that poetry's dead, I just laugh at them. You want to know what's on the minds of Portland youth, just come to Verslandia. You may or may not want to know what's on the minds of Portland youth, but you will find out if you're there. And they're just incredible kids. I can't imagine being 15 and performing a 3-minute poem of my own creation with no notes in front of 900 people.
Is that, they can't have notes?
It's not read, it's performed. Really? That's part of spoken words to history and culture. So they just get up there and perform. And it's, I wouldn't do that now.
Yeah.
So it's, I really admire and I'm excited by those kids. You know, I feel positive and energized, and, you know, it's a good reason to get up in the morning. Well, the exciting thing is we've been working on that event and building it, building support for it and building a participation in it. So next year it actually goes to the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. So it will go to the largest concert hall in the entire city, which is a 2,000-seat-plus hall. So we're pretty stoked about... because I think it's a statement about our youth. It's a statement about poetry. It's a statement about literature's role. So being in the concert hall for us, for Verslandia and for arts and lectures and for a variety of events, is really important to us, partly because of the architecture of the statement of that venue. I have no doubt that it'll be a far more political event overall than we've seen in recent years. I think it's sort of inevitable. I think that those kids will be reflecting on this election. Many of those students have never had any other president in their lives that they're aware of except Barack Obama.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think we just need to be thoughtful and know that that's what's going to happen. We have no interest in telling anyone what to say.
Yeah.
That's not our role.
You're kind of a young guy. I expected an older man, to be honest.
I'm 43, so age is all relative, my friend. Around this office, which is full of really smart, amazing young people, I'm the owly old guy,
right?
I think. But relative to other things, I'm younger than some and older than most, or older than most and younger than some.
Now, I heard a lot of your backstory because I listened to The Job, which was an amazing podcast.
Yeah.
Run by Need More Designs, a local podcast. I loved it.
Need More, too. They're a supporter of the organization.
If you could give us a brief summary of your background, because you're the guy that runs things here. Yeah. So if you could indulge us.
Yeah, that's very nice of you to be interested. I think the most important thing to say is, in some ways, I failed my way to the top.
Humble, very Canadian.
Yeah, very Canadian. But I actually think it's like... really important.
Failed your way to the top.
Kind of. So you know, if you really want to know, I mean, I think that
I wish I could fail like this.
That's right. Well, trust me, you can. Right. What I would say about that is that I think you get asked questions about your career, and then you recite your resume, and it sounds like this straight line from college to the director's office. And you know, I think, when I talk honestly with my peers, it's anything but. I have an 8-year-old at home. Nobody in my son's grade 2 class is like, when I grow up, I'm going to be an arts administrator, right? There are firemen and policemen.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So, you know, I think, you know, when I sought advice and was thinking about my career as a younger person, I use younger, not a young person, I really appreciated when people were actually honest with me about the circuitous route that they really actually were on, oftentimes in their career. So
that's interesting.
It's real. I mean, I think that, you know, the process of living your life creatively is one of discovery, not of like deciding in 15 years I'm going to be this and I'm good and all I'm going to do is just do that thing. I suppose if you want to be an actuary, that's what happens. But for a lot of us who have liberal arts degrees and are going to enter the creative economy, whether that's in the for-profit or not-for-profit world, I consider us part of the creative economy, then you're going to find yourself on a crazy route and you're going to be lost in the woods several times, and totally unsure. So I went to college and I was born in Canada in a little small town.
You're a very humble man.
Well, I just think that this is like, I mean, I went to college in Montreal, yeah, and I did an English and creative writing degree, and I, you know, was writing a lot, and I also had an undergraduate in music. And I started playing music and started writing, and it turns out like I have no talent. So I actually became a professional musician for a very brief period of time, but I can remember very clearly as a saxophone player standing on the bandstand in Montreal playing at a, you know, some nowhere club, nothing famous. And the guy beside me was playing, all friends. And when I just had this moment where he was playing and I thought, this guy who works real hard and practices a lot also has something intangible and totally innate that makes this extremely natural to him.
Yeah.
And I don't have any of that. And that was like an important like revelation to me. I have always enjoyed. I still enjoy.
I remember you saying that.
Yeah. So it was like
on
a big
the job podcast.
It was a big moment for me. And then the same is true sort of in my writing life. Like I sort of had written a lot with stories and this and that. And you know, it just became clear to me that.
Well, you have different strengths. I mean, that's one thing that I think is important. Finding your path is finding what you're not good at and really diving in headfirst into what you are good at.
I don't think it's important to be like, well, that can be really painful for people, and that's fine. But then you've got to get on with it and like really embrace what the next thing is.
Yes.
And so, you know, I ended up in the UK and went to college, went to a master's degree in English and lived in London and worked for the Canadian Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade in Cultural Affairs in London. But all the way along this process, right from high school, I had always been the guy somehow that ended up being the proverbial band manager, right? Somehow the task got left to me. And even so much as I would write plays when I was in college, I'd bring them back to my hometown in Canada, and I would like rent the theater and raise the money and put on the play. I even went so far as to create a house painting company so that I could employ all the actors so that they could be around to be in the play. Like it's a very elaborate scheme, right? And it turns out the thing that I got, the whatever small modicum of talent I have, has something to do with being able to exist both in the artistic world and being able to relate to artists and creative people who don't move in straight lines, but also be able to relate to the people for whom straight lines are very important and are about the business model.
You know, you sound exactly like Joe Nosemack, who runs Oni Press.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he said the exact same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a different skill set, but absolutely necessary to help these people, these creatives.
It's fantastic. I get to hang. I grew up around painters and musicians and writers, so I just assumed that was what I was supposed to do, and it was a little hard to like accept that. But then you found this idea, like, oh, well, wait.
Yeah.
I mean, and when you begin to realize I can.
There's a creative element to that too. What you do?
Oh yeah. I mean, I feel like I'm not an artist, and I would really put a pretty hard definition between being really creative and being an artist, and I would. Really, my job is to elevate artists, and so would never associate myself that professionally. But
mission accomplished.
But yeah, really. but it's certainly I use a.
Well, you gave me a tour earlier. I think mission is accomplished. Yeah, you've definitely elevated the medium.
There's more, and there's lots more to do for us. But I feel that I certainly use a ton of creative energy. I love being around creative people.
Yeah.
I love to see it when we can generate audience. Like so. we're good here at generating large audiences, and that takes some creative energy.
Yeah, you keep selling out pretty much as soon as the tickets are available for the Portland Arts and Lecture Series.
Yeah, it's the largest lecture series in the country of its kind.
No, we kind of cut off your path here.
Oh.
We kind of ventured off. Okay, so, you're in England. You're in England.
I'm in England. Department of Foreign Affairs for Canada, a job that I got totally by accident. And that was the first time I'd worked in sort of culture where, A, I wasn't the primary creator, and I was learning to interact.
You have a lot of respect for the Brits. I remember that.
Yeah, I loved... I would have stayed in London if they hadn't kicked me out, but they kicked me out.
We do that.
That's right. I mean, it's a small island. I understand, right? So I was living in London, and I became a professional house sitter for a little while and was taking care of people's houses.
Really?
Yeah. That's also accidental. It's a story of being open to crazy possibilities. I house sat for a guy who worked in the city, a wealthy guy at a brokerage firm.
Well, I need to do that.
Yeah.
Well, it was amazing though, because what happened is I house sat for him. He paid me. I forget what it was.
You're a professional house sitter.
Yeah, it was it felt like an extravagant amount of money. I can't remember what it was, and I had to look. He had a house in Knightsbridge. And like a designer dog that had a skin disease and was like totally blind or something. Yeah. And he just said, I'm going to go to Hong Kong for this thing and I'm going to be away for 3 weeks. You just have to look after the house, take care of the dog, make sure the plants are watered. You may not throw any parties. And I'll give you I'll give you money and no rent.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, that sounds easy. And so I did it and I took after the house. And I didn't throw any parties and I looked. The dog was fine when he got back. And he was ecstatic. And he told all his buddies, and so they began to pass me around the office. And so I would just house sit for all these different guys. I have very little. I think I left England with £1,000 after I bought the plane ticket. And so it was definitely a job search on a timer, for sure. But I got lucky and got hired at HarperCollins by somebody who publishes.
Not too shabby.
No, it was great. And so, but this is where we get back to the sort of failure part a little bit, because I worked for an incredible editor, a woman named Terry Carton, who publishes Louise Erdrich, Isabel Allende, Barbara Kingsolver, Milan Kundera, Doris Lessing. I mean, her stable of writers is phenomenal. And she's a real taskmaster, but she's great. And I rose to associate editor under her, but realized I was probably never going to become an editor. And that also became pretty clear to me for a variety of reasons, which was also really disappointing. And then the story flips because I took a job at that point at Pan American Center, which is a nonprofit human rights organization, that's focused on the welfare of writers wherever they're persecuted or imperiled. And arrived at a great moment when the organization was in a expansion mode and in a kind of reimagining what its role was going to be in our society. This is 2004, and just like found my calling in that job. Just I got it. Like I understand what this how this works. The idea that there's this whole profession of arts administration where you are elevating the arts. And you're doing so for a variety of reasons. Some of it has to do with civic life. Some of it has to do with artistic life. Some of it has to do with aesthetics.
Literary arts has grown under your supervision.
Yeah, we've grown a lot. But I, under my supervision is a good way to say it, because an enormous number of people are involved with that process.
I mean, like the director, like a film director would.
It's a massive collaborative effort. I mean, you're talking about over. There are 15 staff, 22 board members, 72 people who serve on committees. That's not including the volunteers.
That is a lot of people. Yeah, 72 people.
Serve on various committees, and you have hundreds of people who make substantial financial contributions to the organization who have a stake. They're true stakeholders who we work with all the time. So my job is like about kind of coordinating this incredible effort. To give it the largest impact we could possibly have, both for the community and for the writers that we serve. So here's what I think is really exciting about Portland and about Oregon right now.
Yeah.
And maybe it's something in the water. Maybe it's a moment in time. I absolutely do not think that the work that we're doing would be possible in New York City. New York City is a city of global head offices. It's a very mature market. It's of course evolving, but Portland's in a place right now where it's in a state of becoming, and there are some really risky things about that, and I articulated some of them around housing. But there's also some incredibly exciting things. I mean, people are arriving here from all over the world, and they are ready to do something, and they're making stuff. And so I think the opportunity...
It's buzzing.
Yeah, and the opportunity for myself, for my staff, for my board, is like, guys, we're going to get to make something. Like, we're going to build an organization that will endure and will be a leader in our field.
And you're literally building, too, the offices here downtown.
That's right. So, so that, like, stop and think about that for a moment, because that is an exceptional opportunity that you can't create, right? I mean, you can a little bit, but also the conditions have to be right. The community has to be ready.
Yeah.
And you know, building this space, which is beautiful, and is because Bora Architects...
It really is beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, and Bora Architects decided... Like that this was important to them as a pro bono client. So all this architecture is pro bono, and they design it. And I have to just to say, like, in the spirit of what this city can do, Bora Architects works for a lot of big clients. Stanford's one of them.
It looks like Herman Miller almost.
That's right. And so they, they have a lot of big clients. They're very busy. But there was an architect here, and this is we're talking 5,500-6,000 square feet total. There was an architect here every day during the build out, totally pro bono, making sure that everything was right, because they just got invested in the project. And to be in a city where a big firm like that, who has money to make and things to fulfill and big clients to deal with, that they would spend that amount of time with us is it's remarkable.
It is remarkable.
And it happens over and over and over again with different companies and individuals. And so that's what I mean. We get back to this idea of, like, it's very easy to say, well, Andrew Proctor grew the organization. Well, I don't really actually don't believe that. I think that this community of people who work for this organization as volunteers, as paid staff, as board members, as donors, or whatever, really have transformed the organization the last 7 years in a really way that's thrilling.
Yeah. I think I read somewhere that the definition of success is being prepared and being lucky.
Yeah. Luck, of course, plays into it, and the organization, again, I want to say, in 2009 was in good shape.
Yeah.
We weren't, battling out of massive debt, or those are difficult and thorny problems to solve, and that is not what was in front of us. And I think we have been incredibly fortunate, incredibly lucky.
Now, I just want to wrap up by talking about the 2017-2018 Portland Arts and Lectures event.
I got nothing for you.
Nothing for me?
I got nothing for you.
I'll wrap that up pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we will, of course, be bringing the Moth back next year. Okay.
We're excited.
Yeah, Moth's amazing. We don't announce the 2017-2018 season until April, when our last event, and I am only in the early phases of trying to book that season, which is always a harrowing experience. I was just in New York a week ago. I spent a week in New York talking to the big publishers and shaking the publishing tree to learn what's coming out, making sure that we're top on their list for their best writers to come out and talk to us.
I love it. You're thinking big, and Portland's getting a lot bigger because of it.
I mean, because of a lot of people. I mean, if I look at what our other institutions are doing, it's incredible. I mean, I love to watch, the Portland Art Museum getting a rare Francis Bacon painting in.
Yeah.
Or, the theater companies taking huge risks at Portland Center Stage or ART. I mean, I think it's a really exciting group.
How can people get involved? Do they look at the website? Can you tell us how
the
regular folks can connect with Literary Arts?
I mean, the best thing to do is to go to literary-arts.org. That's the website. And get on the newsletter email list. We're also on Facebook. We're also on Twitter, of course. We're on Instagram. But getting on that email list means that you get first look at tickets. It means you get the news about classes, workshops, seminars.
Those tickets go quick.
The tickets go very quick. I mean, the Moth sold up extremely quickly. Arts and Lectures subscriptions were gone by the summer. We only went on sale in April. I mean, it was a couple months, and they were just gone. So yeah, go to the website, get on the e-news list, follow us on social media, and updates are there on a daily basis about what's going on in the organization.
Thank you, Andrew. You've been listening to the Weekly Portland Podcast. We're at pdxpod.com. That's pdxpod.com. We shall see you next week.
See you then. Blah, 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 blah.